Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Inciter's insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Chauncey Bailey was the first journalist in the U.S. to be killed for doing his job since the 1970s. We'll explore the reasons behind his assassination. Then on the Scholar Circle, the multiple issues behind the latest round of protests in the Middle East. On an August morning in 2007, Chauncey Bailey, a longtime reporter in Oakland, was gunned down for a story he was working on. It was the first time a journalist had been killed in the U.S. for doing his job since the 1970s. Why would someone target Chauncey Bailey? We have with us Thomas Peel. He's the author of Killing the Messenger, a story of radical faith, racism's backlash, and the assassination of a journalist. Welcome, Thomas Peel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you with us. Chauncey Bailey, he was the first journalist to be killed in the U.S. for doing his job since what, 1973, I think you said?
1976.
So let's start with the journalist himself, Chauncey Bailey. It didn't seem like he was doing intense investigative journalism.
No, he wasn't. Chauncey was, in his heart, a community reporter. He found and saw stories everywhere. He was incredibly productive. He didn't do in-depth investigative work, but in Detroit and in Oakland, he covered minority communities in the cliche of kind of like a blanket. He was out in the community. He was a master at writing multiple short daily newspaper stories a day when he worked for daily newspapers. And he was the kind of reporter that really carried newspapers. You know, when newspapers used to be flush, you know, for those of us who can remember that, sometimes editors' problems weren't having enough news, they were having too much news or having too much space in the newspaper and needing to fill it. And that's what Chauncey was really good at. He was good at, as one editor told me for the book, you know, getting a story, getting it down, getting it in, moving on to the next story. Who he was as a reporter.
And it seemed, particularly from your portrayal of him and about what his ultimate death uncovered, that he was really wanting to support his community. He was African-American himself, really wanted to see African-Americans succeed.
He did. He would write stories about people trying to start businesses and give them a little bit of a boost. He was empathetic to people who were trying to make it because he seemed in his life to always be trying to make it himself. And he ended up as editor of the Oakland Post, which is a small free circulation tabloid, sometimes only 8 pages once a week.
So it seems sort of bizarre in the juxtaposition of him then being targeted for assassination by an organization that was also an African-American group.
Let's take the juxtaposition first. It's ironic that somebody who was as supportive of his fellow African-Americans as Chauncey would end up dead at the hands of a leader of a supposed African-American empowerment organization. But the people who were responsible for Chauncey's death kind of hid behind that image, particularly the young man who ordered his assassination, a young man named Yusuf Bey IV. He was good at propping up this image that his organization only existed to help people, but in fact, the only person that he wanted to help was himself. And he also had a very rigid view of the world in that he saw people who were not with him completely as being against him. And that is how he saw Chauncey when Chauncey started working on a story about his organization, which, you know, we all know was known as Your Black Muslim Bakery.
Yusuf Bey, let's talk about him and how this organization sprang up. Give us the backdrop of that.
Yusuf Bey, I will refer to him going forward now as Bey the Elder. He was the patriarch of this organization, and I like to say that he had a little George Foreman in him and that he named 5 sons after himself. He was a hairdresser, of all things, and he and his brother, their last name was Stevens, before they converted to becoming Black Muslims, they ran a hair salon in Santa Barbara, California, in the early 1960s. At one point, they decided to go to Los Angeles to check out the Black Muslims. And the Black Muslims were in the news a lot in Los Angeles because they had had a horrible encounter with the Los Angeles Police Department. Several members of a mosque there had been shot. There had been some brutalizations. Some people who were the subject of police abuses were, in fact, charged with assaulting police. History has borne out that police were really the aggressor in this horrible situation because they were very fearful of the Black Muslims. And eventually Malcolm X came out from New York when he was still a member of the Nation of Islam, and he was leading a bit of a revolt against the Los Angeles Police Department. It made a lot of news, and eventually that made its way up to Santa Barbara, and the Stevens brothers got interested, and they went down to Los Angeles, and they eventually converted to become members of the Nation of Islam. They won permission from Elijah Muhammad to open a small mosque in Santa Barbara. Bay the Elder, then still going by the name Joseph X. Stevens, was the mosque secretary, second in command, and his brother Billy X. Stevens was the minister. In August of 1968, two members of that mosque were shot dead in Santa Barbara, a husband and wife who were shot dead in their bed in the middle of the night. No one was ever charged with their killing, but it's very apparent from reading police reports that the Stevens brothers were somehow involved in the murder, either enabling it or one of them pulling the trigger himself. It just didn't add up their stories to the police. And it turns out that the man who was killed had complained to Elijah Muhammad in Chicago that the Stevens brothers were making him commit fraud crimes. In fact, he was twice ordered to steal Cadillacs belonging to their mother, drive them down into Ventura County, and torch them for the insurance money. He complained about that, being forced to do that, and that's how he was dealt with. He was shot dead. Eventually, after several months of very intense police scrutiny, Stevens brothers closed shop in Santa Barbara and they moved to Oakland. They had been raised in Oakland as young men. They'd been born in Texas, but their parents came west at the start of World War II. Their father was a shipyard worker, found employment in California after President Roosevelt desegregated the naval shipyards in the Bay Area for the war effort. So they came back to Oakland in early 1969 after these murders, and they eventually opened a Nation of Islam mosque in Oakland. But it was a little bizarre because it wasn't independent. They were under another minister in San Francisco. That led to a lot of bad situations back and forth between Oakland and San Francisco. And eventually there was a three-way split. San Francisco went its own way with its own mosque with no control over Oakland. Bay the Elder's brother, Billy, became the Nation of Islam minister in Oakland. And Bay the Elder broke off in the Nation of Islam entirely in the early 1970s. And his position was he wanted to run his own business and not have to contribute money to Chicago. But he continued to practice the same belief system as Farad, who was the person that the black Muslims worshipped as God. And he as Allah. And that was who Bay continued to worship, but he was separate from the Nation of Islam. I kind of liken it to, in terms of, say, a Baptist minister leaving a National Baptist organization but still worshiping Jesus, but doing it independently.
This was quite different from other Muslim organizations. The philosophy was quite different. It has a supremacist aspect to it. Can you give us a sense of the organization?
The belief system began in Detroit in 1930, when Mr. Farad, who had been in prison in California on a drug charge, showed up in Detroit selling silks and raincoats in the ghetto. That was kind of his shtick, and he was a natural salesman. And he would work door-to-door with people, and he would eventually start telling folks that he had come to save them, that he was a savior, and that he had come from Mecca. And he was telling people who had come north in the Great Migration, these descendants of slaves, that everything they knew to be true was false, and that their native religion in Africa was not Christianity, it was Islam. But it was Farad's version of Islam. It was not Islam as taught by the Prophet Muhammad and worshipped by billions of people around the world. It wasn't even close. Farad insisted that he was God in the flesh, which we know is blasphemy to an Orthodox Muslim. He insisted that there was a spaceship orbiting the earth that only he and his followers could see, and that it was always preparing to launch bombers that would start Armageddon. He insisted that people of color were the world's master race, and that they had been the world's master race until 6,600 years earlier, when a mad scientist performed a series of grafting experiments and made the devil, who he he said, were Caucasians and Jews. It was a very bizarre story that he foisted on very ignorant people. But he was also able to drive a wedge in these people's belief system, because he asked them how they could worship the same God that their oppressors worshipped and used to justify their oppression. And that was something that got people's attention. And he won hundreds of converts in Detroit. And in 1932, his organization became known to authorities after a member of it committed a human sacrifice murder. There were reports never fully proven that they were killing people of other races. It became a mess very quickly. But among the people who bought into this rhetoric was a man named Elijah Poole, who the world now knows as Elijah Muhammad. And while Farad disappeared by 1934, Elijah Muhammad had become his chief disciple and spent the next 40 years of his life preaching Farad's belief system to people. And that's eventually how Bey the Elder came to believe in it.
So Bey,
a disciple of Elijah Muhammad.
So Yusuf Bey the Elder, he's got this bakery which is employing a lot of African Americans who would have been either in prison or at risk. So he's really, in a way, providing something very important to that community. But at the same,
he was providing jobs to very poor people. When he started this in the early 70s, there were not a lot of employers in the Oakland ghettos, for sure. I mean, this was almost unheard of that an entrepreneur would come in and open something like a commercial bakery. And by 1973, he had so many retail demands for his baked goods that he was running 24 hours a day. And he had a midnight shift of people to come in to bake bread. This was really a very rare event that there were this type of job opportunities in the Oakland Flats in the early 1970s.
And then at the same time, you implied that there's all of this racket going on in the background. So by the time he dies of cancer, he's being charged with rape, some 27 counts of rape, and a host of other accusations. But before then, nobody would ever look into this.
No, he managed to build shrouds around himself and his organization. He was able to prop himself up with this idea that he alone could save poor people. And while he did offer them jobs, those jobs came with a great deal of attachments. People had to convert to his belief system. Men had to be willing to commit violence against others at the snap of his finger. And women, he preached, had to learn to submit to him completely. He was, in his heart, a polygamous cult leader, because that's really what this organization became. It was a polygamous cult. At any given time, there were a dozen or more women within his compound who considered themselves to be his plural wives. He fathered more than 40 children, probably a lot more. We can document like 43 or 44 of them by various women, some of whom bore his children when they were as young as 13. He was a child rapist. He was a very, very vociferous sexual predator.
They never did manage to convict him because he died first, right?
Right. He died of AIDS in 2003 after being charged in 2002 with these crimes, and his defense was to drag it out. And he knew he was going to die. He did not want that conviction on his record when it happened. And he eventually got so sick he couldn't go to court, and the case ended with his death. And it allowed his followers, who believed in him very much, believed in him as a godlike figure, to say that he'd never been convicted of anything, that it was simply the system and specifically white people out to destroy him.
So then let's connect this back to Chauncey Bailey, the journalist,
sure,
who had been covering the bakery and the Bey family, but really was not digging that deeply. Why was he targeted? Why was he assassinated?
After Bey died, there was a bloody feud within the organization for the right of succession. Bey's first appointed successor was dead within a matter of months. One of his young sons, Antar Bey, took over the organization. He borrowed a great deal of money from a finance company saying he was going to expand the bakery, he was going to open another bakery in Los Angeles. In less than 2 years, he was dead, and it turns out that his youngest brother, Yusuf Bey IV, ordered that killing. So in 2005, 19-year-old Yusuf Bey IV, again one of the many sons that Bey the Elder named after himself, was now in charge of the bakery and various criminal enterprises that supported it. And he was very much his father's son. He spoke very openly about creating the same type of polygamist organization that had flourished for years under his father. One thing we didn't talk about was the fact that in 1994, Bay the Elder ran for mayor of Oakland in a very crowded June primary, open primary field, and won about 5% of the vote. And he used that to start to garner political power. You know, pretty small percentage of the vote, but he was looked upon as representing a constituency and somebody who could deliver that constituency in a tight election. That gave him a lot of power, and he managed to then win contracts to sell his food in public venues like the Oakland Airport and the Oakland Coliseum, and borrow a great deal of money from the city of Oakland that was never paid back. And it allowed his sons to see him as a force. And when Yusuf Bey IV took over the organization in 2005, he began to want to replicate that force himself. He was 19 years old. He had no idea how to run a business. He stopped paying withholding taxes to the IRS. He stopped paying back the very, very large loans that his brother Antar had taken out with the bakery as collateral. And less than a year after he got control of the organization, he was forced to file for bankruptcy protection. He couldn't come up with a plan to satisfy the judge that he could reorganize the business and satisfy his debts, and that bankruptcy protection moved into a case where the bakery was going to be liquidated. Chauncey had covered the bakery on and off for years. He'd written about it for the Oakland Tribune. He'd covered many of Bay the Elder's court appearances in that sex case, and he was tipped off in July of 2007 that he should look into the bankruptcy proceeding with the bakery. And he was doing that and working on a story about Yusuf Bey IV for the Oakland Post, the little weekly paper that he was now editor of, in the weeks before he was killed.
The television station that Chauncey Bailey worked for would not run any of the material, but the newspaper did.
Well, the newspaper ran his stories about Bey the Elder's sex case, which was big news in Oakland because here was this supposedly pious minister and politician who is now charged with raping 13-year-old girls. It was a sensational story. Chauncey covered that for the Oakland Tribune, but he also worked as the news director of a small independent television station in Oakland that was on cable, a station called Soulbeat. And it happened that Bey the Elder had a show on Soulbeat in which he gave a weekly sermon, and he paid for that. It was paid advertising to the bakery. So Bey the Elder told the station owner that if Chauncey Bailey's newscast included anything about this sex case and these rape allegations, that he was going to cancel his paid advertising. And the station owner prohibited Chauncey from reporting anything to do with the sex case. It was a very untenable situation. And it again gave Bey this sense of power that was eventually transferred to his son. So when young Yusuf Bey IV in the summer of 2007 found out that Chauncey Bailey was going to be writing about this bankruptcy case, he was absolutely livid about it and believed that he should not be the subject of such journalistic scrutiny.
So the latest story didn't even run in the newspaper.
No, Chauncey was working on a story. He'd had a source of someone who had been in the organization, who believed that Bey IV was the illegitimate leader of it and was hoping that the bakery could emerge from the bankruptcy proceedings with a different leadership in place. It was not something that was going to happen given the amount of debt that it had, but it's what they wanted, what this other man named Salim Bey, who had been married to one of Bey the Elder's daughters, wanted. And he was trying to get Chauncey to write about the bankruptcy proceeding because he thought that might further his ends.
It just seems so dramatic to assassinate a reporter who hasn't even written a particularly negative story.
It was a story straight up out of the bankruptcy proceeding. It's a public proceeding. It had, in fact, been reported in local business journals that report every bankruptcy filing. It wasn't a secret. And that's one of the most ironic things about it. What Chauncey was reporting on wasn't a secret. But he had written a story The publisher of the Oakland Post, a man named Paul Cobb, had rejected at first publishing it. He claimed there wasn't enough attribution in it, kind of thought that Mr. Cobb had been around Oakland long enough to know that the Bays were dangerous, and he was being very cautious about running even a fairly innocuous story about them. Chauncey very much wanted to get that story into the newspaper, though. That's who he was. And he wanted to get this story done.
So in the end, the Bay, the fourth, you call him the fourth throughout the book,
right,
did end up going to prison.
He did, because he decided that the best way to deal with Chauncey Bailey writing a story about this bankruptcy proceeding was to send out two of his young minions, a kid named Devondre Brassard, who was 19, another fellow named Antoine Mackey, who was 21. He would send them out to find Chauncey Bailey and shoot him dead. And on the morning of August 2nd, 2007, that's exactly what they did. They found Chauncey walking to work. Brassard was dressed in all black with a ski mask over his head, and he ran up to Chauncey in downtown Oakland, two blocks from Chauncey's office, and got right up on top of him with this little pistol grip 12-gauge shotgun, and he shot him three times, and Chauncey was dead on the sidewalk in a matter of seconds.
Now, by this point, the authorities, who had been steering clear of the entire Bay operation, were no longer steering clear.
That is correct. This wasn't the first crime, this ordering of Chauncey Bailey, the journalist killed, that Yusuf Bey IV had committed in 2007. He had ordered, ironically enough, two other men killed a month earlier. He was also the mastermind of a bizarre kidnapping and torture plot of a woman to try to learn where a local drug dealer stashed money and cocaine. And he was under police investigation. This was a change in Oakland because the Oakland Police Department for years had had a policy of not engaging the Bays. They were kind of left alone. They were left alone to police their neighborhood in North Oakland, and they were left alone to kind of fend for themselves. But the police could not ignore two murders, and they could not ignore the kidnapping and torture of this woman that was very bizarre and brazen, and also was broken up incredibly by a police officer who literally stumbled on the scene and saved this poor woman's life. So the police were coming for these guys. And on August 1st, the day before Chauncey was killed, they had scheduled a massive raid of the Bay compound involving 200 SWAT cops, biggest operation in the history of the Oakland Police Department. But then at the last minute, it was postponed for 2 days because several SWAT commanders were on vacation and the police chief didn't want to proceed without them being back and being the leaders of the operation. So suddenly there was this 48-hour window, and it was during that 48-hour window that Brassard and Mackey tracked down Mr. Bailey and killed him. Then on the morning of August 3rd, the delayed raid took place. Yusuf Bey IV was arrested. Devondre Brassard was arrested. Brassard was seen throwing the murder weapon out a window. He was taken into custody and pursued as the lead suspect in Mr. Bailey's murder. Yusuf Bey IV was charged in the kidnapping and torture case that I just mentioned.
Your subtitle, A Story of Radical Faith, Racism's Backlash and the Assassination of Journalists. When you look at the racism's backlash aspect, and you wrote about this quite a bit in one of your chapters in terms of the institutional racism and how that really fed into creating this hatred between races, which may have given birth to this, and yet the victim is also African American.
Sure, I was just going to say that the black Muslim movement, as effective as it was, especially at its beginning, was in direct response to white racism. When W.D. Farad wandered the Detroit ghettos and started telling people that they should believe that white people were the devil, many of them looked back at where they had come from, the lynchings they had fled in the South, and realized that perhaps white people were the devil. And this question that Mr. Farad asked of people who were might be ignorant in the ways of the larger world, but bearing a deep native intelligence. And he asked the question of these people, how can you worship the God that your oppressor worships and uses to justify your oppression? That was a question that they could not intellectually turn away from. And they took up these belief systems out of anger and frustration and reflecting back on those who hated them that very hatred.
Well, Thomas Peel, Killing the Messenger, A Story of Radical Faith, Racism's Backlash, and the Assassination of a Journalist. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Maria. Thank you for having me.
It's time for peace. It's time for peace. Oh, what are we fighting for? It's time for peace. Time for peace. It's time for peace. Oh, yeah. Time for peace. We'll stop the killing fields in the desert sand.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Last week, protests continued across the Middle East. In Pakistan, where thousands rose in protest, 17 people were killed. What are the factors driving these protests? Three political science experts join us. Roger Peterson is professor of political science at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and author of numerous books, including Western Intervention in the Balkans, Understanding Ethnic Violence, Fear, Hatred, and Resentment in 20th Century Eastern Europe, and Resistance and Rebellion, Lessons from Eastern Europe. Deepak Gupta joins us. He is Distinguished Professor at the Department of Political Science at San Diego State University and author of Understanding Terrorism and Political Violence, The Life Cycle of Birth, Growth, Transformation, and Demise, and The Path to Collective Madness, A Study in Social Order and Pathology. Hamoud Salhi also joins us. He is Chair of the Negotiation, Conflict Resolution, and Peace Building Program and Professor of Political Science at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He is also host of Swana Region Radio on Pacifica Radio's KPFK, and a regular commentator on Algeria National Television and Radio. Hamoud Salhi, let's start with the dynamics of the protest. Who are the protesters and what is driving it?
It's difficult to say because the impression that we're getting that the Islamists are demonstrating, but there are some serious issues underlying this protest which drives other people into the streets, namely the turn of Arab Spring into more of a chaotic situation, the failed promises that what was depicted as a revolution is turned into chaos that is affecting the Middle East. Underneath that, there is also the failed of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. The entire peace process has failed. So protesters are not just Islamists. There are also populists who just want to protest against what they see as unfair and just. And in that segment, in that protest, the Islamists seems to be the driving force because they think that they own the issue of Islam, that they understand it better than others, and it's their duty to go to the streets. That is a wrong way of putting things, but that's the impression we're getting. The issue in itself raises big emotions, regardless of how we interpret it, regardless of how we condemn the demonstration and the killing of the ambassador who happened to be, as we are told, a good friend of the Libyans. So from that perspective, it's the Islamists who are taking the lead. The underlying causes, just others are in the street as well.
Do you have a sense that that film really did catalyze the protests?
I think it's an issue that is very, very important. Touching the Quran is a sensitive issue. Touching the Prophet is a sensitive issue as well. The issue in a movie depicting the Prophet in ways that this film did it, irrespective of its quality of the content, is an issue that is very, very important for the Muslims. And I think it's wrong not to understand it, not to give it some kind of importance. But granted, there are agendas at play. There are many, many factors that could cause the people that have sort of incited people to go to the streets. There are regional issues. Remember, Libya and Egypt are unstable societies, and the agendas are big. The other thing is that this is also at a time when, as is we in the West, we're talking about war, talking about attacking Iran, but the region takes it differently. I mean, some of the demonstrations that we've seen in Iran talk about Israel more than anything else, how Israel can do anything it wants in the region. So, yeah, we could say, you know, it shouldn't be. Some people are using it for their personal agenda, but it doesn't reject the fact that there are some serious issues in the Israeli-Palestinian issue, the Israeli-Arab peace process needs to be looked at seriously, and a solution to the core issues of the regions need to be taken seriously. And I think that's one of the issues that the Arab Spring seems to sort of, people not seem not to give it that much importance. A resolution of that or giving an impression that we're moving in the right directions could actually make things look better.
That would bring in the issues of identity and political psychology. Perhaps we should start with identity. Deepak Gupta, this is your area. How can we understand how identity works with these kinds of situations.
Nothing works better than the concept of fear. Fear and threat, they are the, and a perception of threat, are the primary drivers of people's emotions. You know, I would argue, first of all, I agree with Hamoud that the United States and the West, they become the placement for a lot of anger and frustration. But we also have to know that there is a anger and frustration industry within these societies. None of the riots, none of the violent demonstrations that we see are totally spontaneous. They are organized by groups and the leadership. Just like in this country, we have the Rush Limbaughs and people who really can raise people's level of anger and fear. There are similar groups of people in every single country. And when something like this happens, a film, it becomes, or a cartoon, they become the vehicle through which the anger and frustrations are channeled. And yes, of course, the anger and frustration are real. I'm not denying that. But there is a definite leadership issue coming from the certain groups that take the leadership in these sort of movements.
Roger Peterson.
I'm glad that Professor Gupta brought up the emotion idea, because I think this is helpful to try to untangle what might be going on. One idea about emotions is that you form cognitions or beliefs, and then the emotions follow from them. Of course, the other idea about emotions is you have emotions which affect your beliefs, and both of these are going on. But when you talk about fear, the cognition or the belief is that there is a perception of threat, as Professor Gupta said, and then once you're under the grip of fear, you tend to shape your preferences somewhat differently. For instance, a preference for flight maybe is heightened. Your information changes, your beliefs change. Fear is defined by the perception of threat. Anger is defined by the perception that someone has made a bad action against me, which would be anger at the film. But there's also other emotions. There's the emotion of contempt, where you see the object as somehow inherently defective. The United States is the great Satan. That would be an emotion of contempt. The United States is threatening our values, emotion of fear. The United States has allowed these films or produced these films when people believe that's the emotion of anger. These are sort of specific emotions, especially fear and anger that you might deal with. But in the Middle East, the emotion that I think is maybe most dominant is the emotion of resentment. The cognition there is that we are unfairly dominated. And I think there's a well of anti-Americanism in the Middle East because, let's face it, there is a hierarchy of states. The United States has invaded two Middle East states. They don't invade us. We invade them. We have drones that attack people across the Middle East. The United States is the dominant actor. And so this idea about mobilization people and anger industry, that's undoubtedly partly true. But the bigger question is, does this anger industry function within this broader anti-American resentment of our dominance in the region? If that's true, there's not much we can do about this. If it's mostly a matter of just anger about the film, then Obama and Hillary Clinton can come on TV and try to mitigate that. So how big this problem is, how widespread this problem is, has something to do with how you see the underlying sort of emotional context.
So there's a reality, and then there's the industry that Professor Gupta is talking about, and they together are creating the emotions and then the behaviors. Hamoud Sahi.
Indeed, there are some psychological factors. The emotions that Dr. Peterson is talking about are real. I mean, these are not something we should ignore. The stress, frustration, the internal problems that these countries are facing, the frustration with also with what Obama, President Obama, has brought to the region. Just remember, I mean, this is over more than 3 years ago when President Obama made this huge speech in Cairo where he told the region, look, I'm here, I'm a good guy, I'm going to make things happen better. border, but nothing has happened. Those are real issues. Now, the extent that we need to look at is how much of this frustration leads to this kind of activities. Certainly, the agenda that the Iranians have in the regions, the Syrians have for the region, perhaps. And then not forget what's happening in the Sahel, in the Northern Africa, west of North Africa. There is Mali, for example, or half of the country was until recently controlled by the Islamist jihadists. The United States has spent so much money in that region. Hillary Clinton was in Morocco and she signed a treaty of cooperation, including security with the United States. And Morocco was hailed as an example of democratic change. Certainly, the Moroccans don't view that as a real thing. The Arab Spring was about change. And for a moment, we thought there was something happening there, and the world, the Western world, the United States, understood the underlying reason for such a change, and it was about time to start moving ahead. But what we ended up doing is seeing more of a winter, people are calling it, or a chaos that is spread in the entire region, and the region is suffering. Now, again, I cannot stop reemphasizing the idea of how we take things lightly when you talk about invading another country, attacking nuclear facilities of Iran, or attacking the Palestinians. We really report as news, but in the region, it means a lot. It means a destruction of the whole infrastructure. It means another war in the region. And if we just look at the numbers, since 1980, the Gulf region has not seen a day without war. It's been wars after wars after wars. We are seeing generations that have seen only wars.
You make a couple of really important points. One, this idea that it's been continuous war. And these conflicts then, as I understand it, reinforce first the insecurity and the fear and the sense of threat and the anger and the resentment. Also reinforce the identities, the us versus them. Deepak Gupta, how would you respond to that?
Well, these are all the ingredients that create the identity of us versus them. And historically, the Islamic world has seen all the invasions and the painful memories of colonization. So there is a ready set of demons that are already there. And if you really look at it today, the only countries that have been invaded today are the Muslim countries. When there are drone strikes, you know, a lot of people die, and they're all Muslims. Therefore, given the fact that Islam has a very strong identity embedded within the religion of Ummah, which means the community, so anything happens to another Muslim, regardless of nationality, it hurts everybody. Now, that is one of the fundamental tenets of Islam, and that is probably one of the reasons of it spread throughout the world, where people felt that they were part of this large community. Therefore, I believe that when Islamic communities or Islamic countries are being invaded or they are attacked, there is some sense, regardless of how devout you are or how fundamentalist you are, there is a sense of hurt and resentment. You can't escape that. I mean, it's not present in Christianity or in Hinduism or in Buddhism. Therefore, the sense of victimization, the sense of being unfairly attacked is much more pervasive in the Islamic nations, which get reinforced by the leaders who frame the issues in terms of us and them, create this huge conspiracy theory which resonates with a very large number of people. And that's exactly, I think, is what's happening in these countries.
If, in fact, this is reality with regards to the collective sense that really brings in the social psychological aspects of things like the intergroup emotions, groupthink phenomena, this kind of a thing. Roger Peterson, what can you tell us about those?
I think all three of us probably agree that there is a well of sort of anti-Americanism, or what I call resentment of American dominance. U.S. is always talking about attacking, supporting Israel in basically any way. And then there's the framing of this, and that there's an anger industry that leaders frame this for their own benefit. So one of the questions here is, where do we put the relative weight? Is it the framing, or is it the more widespread resentment of American dominance. This is a question I don't know, but it seems to me that when you look at the pattern of variation of these protests, if we would put the weight on the framing and the elite framing of it, we should see a pattern of variation where some states differ quite a bit from other states in that some elites who don't need to use this framing will not use it, but in other cases they will use it. And so do we see a big variation in this across the Arab world, or do we see being very widespread across different political situations? My impression from just reading the news is this is very widespread in cases like Libya, which we thought was one of our success cases, Sudan, Yemen, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq. It seems to me that the weight should be on the bigger and less soluble problem of anti-American sentiment across the region and not on the framing of specific elites. Is that right or not?
You know, you can see that there is a wide variation of expressions of anger. For instance, it's so much more violent in, say, Pakistan than it is in Indonesia, for instance. You know, Indonesia is the largest Islamic country in the world. India has the second largest Muslim population. There have been some demonstrations in Chennai and New Delhi, but, you know, they're much more muted, or in Jakarta. But then there are people and there are countries where it is used a lot more. And the expressions of anger, if that's how we can test this hypothesis, it provides a very clear case. Like in Jordan, it hasn't been that. But on the other hand, it has been very violent in Libya, whereas the Libyan people, in general, it seems, were embarrassed by what happened. In Egypt, it did happen. In Yemen, it did happen very violently. But it did not happen uniformly across the nations.
Hamoud Salhi.
I think it's a very, very interesting hypothesis, and I think it's very important to look at the variation. But some countries have reacted differently than others. This is a great way of looking at it. But again, I think there is a bigger issue, and I think I tend to lean more on the idea that there are agendas at play. And those agendas seem to weigh more than the anti-sentiment that Professor Peterson is talking about. The reason for it is, for example, if we pick up the region Libya and we look at what happened since the Libyans toppled Muammar Gaddafi, Libya is now a chaotic state. It's divided between two regions, the Benghazi group and the Tripoli's group. The Islamic jihadists have got in now. There is issues of smuggling of arms. There is a jihadist organization very active in the process to a point where it is even difficult to talk about a state in Libya, despite the fact that we had elections in Libya and the Libyan chose a non-Islamist organization to lead them to form the government. Is this an opportunity that the Benghazi will use to bring their agenda in the forefront? On a bigger issue, the Algerian-Moroccan competition in northern Africa over the Sahel area, the idea of establishing the military central command in Africa that the United States have been doing for so many years and has been trying to bring the military forces in Stuttgart to one of the African countries, and Hillary Clinton signing a security agreement with the Moroccans. The Algerians do not take that lightly. They see that any rapprochement with the Moroccan comes at their detriment. And as an example of how the Algerians are very sensitive about the issue, there are evidence today that the Algerians are involved with the Islamists, or they have used their connection with the Islamist fundamentalists to get them very active in Mali, and they are behind the takeover of the jihadists in northern Mali. So there are some serious, serious issues that are in play in that region. So from that perspective, I see the agenda as a bigger problem. But again, I should not be ignoring this anti-sentiment on the other side. Psychological factors, the driving force, as Dr. Gupta said it earlier, you may have spontaneous demonstration in the streets, but one way or another, at one point or another, leaders will use that to their advantage.
All of these factors come together, they build emotion, they build culture, and then you end up going in one direction or the other. So you've got the culture, the religiosity, the emotions, the real hard issues that Hamoud Salhi is talking about, all of them coming together to develop a particular thinking pattern, belief system, and kind of an intergroup emotion. Other issues too, such as poverty, and that brings in a whole nother set of emotions. Roger Peterson.
I think sometimes the problem of Westerners coming in here is just not an understanding the difference in identity groups. I'm reading the New York Times here in the United States and the Muslim World. This is their editorial from September 19th. This is a quote. Instead of demanding that their governments deliver needed jobs and housing, the protesters focused on a crude video promoted by hate-mongering fanatics in the United States. But this idea that, you know, all groups are sort of equivalent and what they should want are things like needed jobs and housing, and that they're like labor unions who get goods. And that's the way I think Americans and a lot of Westerners look at groups, as having these normal types of preferences about jobs and housing and things like this. And I'm not sure all groups have that type of preference function that we want to try to impose on them about jobs and housing. So when we come in and analyze what's happening in Libya, you know, the New York Times is about, well, why aren't these groups acting like we do and just pursuing the stable government, goods and housing? And maybe groups, though religious groups, have different types of preferences. And to understand that, we have to understand the mix of this. And that's why we don't understand these protests as much. I think Professor Salhi or Professor Gupta mentioned Islam has a sense of community, which is very different than the Protestant Christian sense of individuals, and that these things are a different kind of identity group. So I'm not sure that all peoples have the same preferences about government.
You brought up another important point, which is what are the possibilities for resolving this? Hamoud Salhi?
Well, the bottom line, and again, I'm going back to the Arab Spring, but the underlying problem for Arab Spring was economics. Former President Bill Clinton said economic stupid. Economic issues are real, real issues in the Middle East. This is an area that is very, very underdeveloped, and the huge gap that exists between the rich and the poor is manifest at all levels. Now, in addition to that, you have regional disparities. You have the Gulf that is very advanced, very developed, and then you have the rest of the Arab world. We're talking about 14, 15 states that continue to live under very harsh conditions, despite the fact that the region is very rich in oil and other natural resources. There is another issue that we need to look at. It's the issue of identity. We tend to accept to look at the region, either you are Arab, Muslim, and then in between, which is minorities. Now, both of the connotations, the Muslim and the Arabs, are seen pejoratively, that you are an Arab and it comes with huge types of stereotypes. Also, as a Muslim, another type of circumstance within stereotypes. The point is this, the region has yet to define itself, to come up with its own definition, what it is, this region, what kind of identity we have. In the Gulf region, for example, we're still struggling with the idea of, are we Arabs, are we Khalijis, meaning are we the Gulf countries, what are we? And every region has that. If we get deeper, how we view minorities. Egypt, for example, an issue where today is a big, big challenge. Boutros Ghali, Secretary General of the United Nations, was never given the title of foreign minister in Egypt because at the time the constitution of Egypt doesn't allow non-Muslims to hold a key position as a minister. Instead, he was, by the exact title, was minister of the state in charge of foreign affairs. Now, this brings the issue of huge issue of minorities, how minorities are treated in the region. They are treated as second, if not third rank. We are so obsessed with the idea whether the constitution in Egypt, for example, or in Libya or Tunisia or other places, will give more power to the Islamists or seculars or whatever, than the real issues of identity, such as women's rights, such as minority rights, are ignored. The other related issues that we've seen in the Arab Spring is that there is a shift of balance and power in the region. region. Saudi Arabia has emerged as one of the leading sort of anti-Arab change in the region. And it's being supported indirectly by the United States. Granted that there have been sort of different policies, but Saudis are increasingly become a powerful institution. Now, the question of what kind of regional powers, what is the role of these regional powers, what role should the regional powers should take? Linked to that is the role of Qatar, which is also becoming more increasingly involved in the region. The point I'm trying to drive at this is that we have to look at the regional issues, the leadership issues, from a very critical perspective. What is the role of the Arab League in this sense? And what are these countries that big powers are doing to serve their national interests in the regions? Or are they planting seeds for a better world? From what we have seen so far, the role of some certain Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia, has not beneficial to the region, has not benefited these countries. And finally, we need to look at, and again, with a critical perspective, is what are we expected of the United States? What role the United States should play in the region? The United States is everywhere in the region. I mean, we talk about the United States withdrawing from Iraq and having no soldiers there, but most of the soldiers are also in the Gulf region. Today, there are about 110,000 in the Gulf region, including Bahrain and Qatar. What role should we expect of this big power? Are we going to engage the United States in ways that will benefit us, or are we going to disengage? And until we have a solution, and it has to be a solution from within the region, the region sitting down and looking at the problem we are going to face. And above all of these issues, let's not forget the Arab-Israeli conflict. This is a serious, serious problem. And the changes in the Israeli demographic, the changes in the leadership of Israel, the population of Israel since the collapse of the Soviet Union has affected how the Israelis look at the peace process. We've gone the days when Yitzhak Rabin, when Shimon Peres as well, or Begin, or the old leadership who wanted a rapprochement of the Arabs, who thought of the Israeli peace or secure Israel linked to their rapprochement of the Arab. We're beyond that. Today, Prime Minister Netanyahu talks about one state. Candidate Romney talks about the destruction of supporting unconditionally Israel, and then the attack on the Palestinians. We're not even thinking about the consequences of that. We're beyond any kind of sort of reaching a solution where the Israeli leadership, and I'm not blaming anyone, the Israeli leadership and its population, the dynamics have changed in Israeli population, should be looked at. I think my final point is that these are all serious, serious issues, and the region is very, very complex, but we have not touched any of them. And until we start to look at them from that critical perspective, we are going to have problems, and we are going to see the Middle East in chaos and fire, and as we've seen it lately.
Deepak Gupta?
I think Professor Salhi has touched upon many issues which are salient to the problem. I would like to point out, first of all, that there is no magic bullet in this problem. In many countries of the Middle East and in South Asia, they have not been able to develop a civil society yet, where all the democratic institutions work toward the national interest at its very core. These societies are stratified by their own internal conflicts, could be regional, could be ethnic, could be linguistic. And on top of that, we cannot forget that there is a very strong undercurrent of historical rivalry between the Shias and the Sunnis that are playing out in the region through the rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia. So, first of all, I point out that there is no silver bullet. Second thing I would point out, that it's not religion, it's not Islam, because there are many countries. I mentioned Indonesia, Indian Muslim population. They have been able to develop much more of a civil society. And also, we have to understand that within these various countries, there are differences of issues. There are differences of regional rivalries, a Shia-Sunni conflict. So every country is different. So when they are going out and demonstrating and being violent, it's not for the same reason. There are many reasons which are underlying what we see on television screen. So even I believe that it's very important to solve the Arab-Israeli problem, incredibly important, also very important to solve the Kashmir situation. But even if we did solve them, will the regional rivalries, Will the ethnic rivalries, sectarian rivalries, would they go away? Until these nations can develop a civil society based on trust and democratic institutions, deep-rooted democratic institutions, we will see these kinds of outbursts which are fed on some real perception of injustice. Arab-Israeli problem, definitely a huge scar on the minds of most Muslims, just as Kashmir is in the South Asian Muslims. So once again, to sum it up, there is no magic bullet. We cannot look at the entire region as one group. Third, it is certainly not Islam, and it will take time. We will have to be patient. If we give in to the extremists of our society in the West, which is happening all over. Look at France. Some French cartoonists are drawing horrible, horrible, demeaning cartoons of the Prophet. This is not the way to solve the problem. We cannot just impose on them our idea of individual freedom of thought without understanding the context within which they perceive our actions. So we have to be patient, and we have to do things to facilitate resolution of some of these conflicts.
Roger Peterson, what would you add? And also, do you think that there are lessons from your Eastern Europe studies that we can apply here?
I think as a political scientist, we have these theories about modernization. And one of the long-term theories is that, well, if we solve a lot of the economic problems and states start to develop economically, they'll become a middle class, civil society, which will demand more democracy. There'll be a deepening of capitalism and markets, and these things will increase the state and solve a lot of problems. And if you look at Eastern Europe, which was communism, and communism collapsed, the story, it seems to sort of fit. But I'm listening here to my colleagues on the radio, and I'm not sure that this story is, you can expect it to go, because we do have these identity issues, the Sunni-Shia splits, other kinds of problems, the Arab-Israeli problem, which I don't believe is going to be solved in the next 10 years, unfortunately. But, you know, I think that we're going to have a very messy situation, and probably differs from country to country. I have my doubts about the United States' role in this. We already have a track record. State building in Iraq didn't work out quite well. We have this idea about government in a box that we're going to put into Afghanistan and try to get this process going, talk about flipping the Taliban. Our track record is not very good, and I do think there is sort of a larger underlying problem. I think we need to disengage more from the region and actually let the region solve out its own problems and maybe specifically help in this country or that country. But on the whole, this is probably not going to go smoothly according to our political science theories and hopes.
Let me thank the three of you. I so appreciate your time. Professor Hamoud Sahi, Professor Deepak Gupta, and Professor Roger Peterson, thank you all so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to Ankine Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin. If you missed a part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org, go to the audio archives. You can always podcast us and follow us at scholarcircle.org, armudian.com, and on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.